Demons, Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 2. Chapter 1. Night. 8 days had passed. Now that it is all over and I am writing a record of it, we know all about it. But at the time we knew nothing, and it was natural that many things should seem strange to us. Stepan Trofimovich and I, anyway, shut ourselves up for the first part of the time, and looked on with dismay from a distance. I did indeed go about here and there, and, as before, brought him various items of news, without which he could not exist. I need hardly say that there were rumours of the most varied kind going about the town in regard to the blow that Stavrogin had received. Lizaveta Nikolaevna's fainting fit, and all that happened on that Sunday. But what we wondered was, through whom the story had got about so quickly and so accurately. Not one of the persons present had any need to give away the secret of what had happened, or interest to serve by doing so. The servants had not been present. Lebyadkin was the only one who might have chattered, not so much from spite, for he had gone out in great alarm, and fear of an enemy destroys spite against him, but simply from incontinence of speech. But Lebyadkin and his sister had disappeared next day, and nothing could be heard of them. There was no trace of them at Filipov's house. They had moved. No one knew where, and seemed to have vanished. Shatov, of whom I wanted to inquire about Marya Timofyevna, would not open his door, and I believe sat locked up in his room for the whole of those 8 days, even discontinuing his work in the town. He would not see me. I went to see him on Tuesday and knocked at his door. I got no answer, but being convinced by unmistakable evidence that he was at home, I knocked a second time. Then, jumping up, apparently from his bed, he strode to the door and shouted at the top of his voice, "Shatov is not at home!" With that, I went away. Stepan Trofimovich and I, not without dismay at the boldness of the supposition, though we tried to encourage one another, reached at last a conclusion. We made up our mind that the only person who could be responsible for spreading these rumours was Pyotr Stepanovich, though he himself not long after assured his father that he had found the story on everyone's lips, especially at the club, and that the governor and his wife were familiar with every detail of it. What is even more remarkable is that the next day, Monday evening, I met Liputin, and he knew every word that had been passed, so that he must have heard it first-hand. Many of the ladies, and some of the leading ones, were very inquisitive about the mysterious cripple, as they called Marya Timofyevna. There were some, indeed, who were anxious to see her and make her acquaintance, so the intervention of the persons who had been in such haste to conceal the Lebyadkins was timely. But Lizaveta Nikolaevna's fainting certainly took the foremost place in the story, and all society was interested, if only because it directly concerned Yulia Mihailovna as the kinswoman and patroness of the young lady. And what was there they didn't say? What increased the gossip was the mysterious position of affairs. Both houses were obstinately closed. Lizaveta Nikolaevna, so they said, was in bed with brain fever. The same thing was asserted of Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, with the revolting addition of a tooth knocked out and a swollen face. It was even whispered in corners that there would soon be murder among us, that Stavrogin was not the man to put up with such an insult, and that he would kill Shatov, but with the secrecy of a Corsican vendetta. People liked this idea, but the majority of our young people listened with contempt and with an air of the most nonchalant indifference, which was, of course, assumed. The old hostility to Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch in the town was in general strikingly manifest. Even sober-minded people were eager to throw blame on him, though they could not have said for what. It was whispered that he had ruined Lizaveta Nikolaevna's reputation, and that there had been an intrigue between them in Switzerland. Cautious people, of course, restrained themselves, but all listened with relish. There were other things said, though not in public, but in private, on rare occasions and almost in secret. Extremely strange things, to which I only refer to warn my listeners of them with a view to the later events of my story. Some people with knitted brows said, God knows on what foundation, that Nikolai Sievolodovitch had some special business in our province, that he had, through Count K., been brought into touch with exalted circles in Petersburg, that he was even, perhaps, in government service, and might almost be said to have been furnished with some sort of commission from someone. When very sober-minded and sensible people smiled at this rumour, observing, very reasonably, that a man always mixed up with scandals, and who was beginning his career among us with a swollen face, did not look like a government official, they were told in a whisper that he was employed not in the official, but, so to say, the confidential service, and that in such cases it was essential to be as little like an official as possible. This remark produced a sensation. We knew that the Zemstvo of our province was the object of marked attention in the capital. I repeat, these were only flitting rumours that disappeared for a time when Nikolai Sievolodovitch first came among us. But I may observe that many of the rumours were partly due to a few brief but malicious words, vaguely and disconnectedly dropped at the club by a gentleman who had lately returned from Petersburg. This was a retired captain in the Guards, Artemy Pavlovich Gaganov. He was a very large landowner in our province and district, a man used to the society of Petersburg, and the son of the late Pavel Pavlovich Gaganov, the venerable old man with whom Nikolai Sievolodovitch had, over 4 years before, had the extraordinarily coarse and sudden encounter which I have described already in the beginning of my story. It immediately became known to everyone that Yulia Mikhailovna had made a special call on Varvara Petrovna and had been informed at the entrance Her Honour was too unwell to see visitors. It was known, too, that Yulia Mikhailovna sent a message 2 days later to inquire after Varvara Petrovna's health. At last she began defending Varvara Petrovna everywhere, of course only in the loftiest sense, that is, in the vaguest possible way. She listened coldly and sternly to the hurried remarks made at first about the scene on Sunday, so that during the later days they were not renewed in her presence, so that the belief gained ground everywhere that Yulia Mikhailovna knew not only the whole of the mysterious story, but all its secret significance to the smallest detail, and not as an outsider, but as one taking part in it. I may observe, by the way, that she was already gradually beginning to gain that exalted influence among us for which she was so eager, and which she was certainly struggling to win, and was already beginning to see herself surrounded by a circle. A section of society recognized her practical sense and tact, but of that later. Her patronage partly explained Pyotr Stepanovich's rapid success in our society, a success with which Stepan Trofimovich was particularly impressed at the time. We possibly exaggerated it. To begin with, Pyotr Stepanovich seemed to make acquaintance almost instantly with the whole town within the first 4 days of his arrival. He only arrived on Sunday, and on Tuesday I saw him in a carriage with Artemy Pavlovich Gaganov, a man who was proud, irritable, and supercilious, in spite of his good breeding, and who was not easy to get on with. At the governor's, too, Pyotr Stepanovich met with a warm welcome, so much so that he was at once on an intimate footing, like a young friend, treated, so to say, affectionately. He dined with Yulia Mikhailovna almost every day. He had made her acquaintance in Switzerland, but there was certainly something curious about the rapidity of his success in the governor's house. In any case, he was reputed, whether truly or not, to have been at one time a revolutionist abroad. He had had something to do with some publications and some congresses abroad, which one can prove from the newspapers. to quote the malicious remark of Alyosha Telyatnikov, who had also been once a young friend affectionately treated in the house of the late governor, but was now, alas, a clerk on the retired list. The fact was unmistakable. The former revolutionist, far from being hindered from returning to his beloved fatherland, seemed almost to have been encouraged to do so, so perhaps there was nothing in it. Liputin whispered to me once that there were rumours that Pyotr Stepanovich had once professed himself penitent, and, on his return, had been pardoned on mentioning certain names, and so, perhaps, had succeeded in expiating his offence by promising to be of use to the government in the future. I repeated these malignant phrases to Stepan Trofimovich, and although the latter was in such a state that he was hardly capable of reflection, he pondered profoundly. It turned out later that Pyotr Stepanovich had come to us with a very influential letter of recommendation, that he had, at any rate, brought one to the governor's wife from a very important old lady in Petersburg, whose husband was one of the most distinguished old dignitaries in the capital. This old lady, who was Yulia Mikhailovna's godmother, mentioned in her letter that Count K. knew Pyotr Stepanovich very well through Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, made much of him, and thought him a very excellent young man, in spite of his former errors. Yulia Mikhailovna set the greatest value on her relations with the higher spheres, which were few and maintained with difficulty, and was, no doubt, pleased to get the old lady's letter. But still, there was something peculiar about it. She even forced her husband upon a familiar footing with Pyotr Stepanovich, so much so that Mr. von Lebke complained of it, but of that, too, later. I may mention, too, that the great author was also favourably disposed to Pyotr Stepanovich, and at once invited him to go and see him. Such alacrity on the part of a man so puffed up with conceit stung Stepan Trofimovich more painfully than anything, but I put a different interpretation on it. In inviting a nihilist to see him, Mr. Karamazinov no doubt had in view his relations with the progressives of the younger generation in both capitals. The great author trembled nervously before the revolutionary youth of Russia, and imagining in his ignorance that the future lay in their hands, fawned upon them in a despicable way, chiefly because they paid no attention to him whatever.